We got some guests in the building, Slay.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to let you take care of it.
These are my folks from the D.C. offices, Mentor Foundation. We got a world-renowned doctor from NIDA in the building. I'm going to have the boss lady herself introduce herself first. If you want to step into the mic, tell people your name, your position.
Yeah, my name is Kaya Kennebrew, and I'm the program manager with Mentor Foundation USA.
Okay.
I'm Ruben Baller, a scientist with NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Yes, yes.
I got to give out some claps, though. Let me go clap.
Now, Dr. Baylor is actually the first scientist we've ever had on the show.
Yeah,
we've had a lot of doctors.
A lot of doctors,
but never
a
scientist. So I'm excited.
Me
I'm
too.
Definitely excited about this. So, Kai, if you want to talk a little bit about Mentor Foundation's programs, what you do. They know a lot about what goes on in Columbia County, but what other programs does Mentor run?
Yeah, so other than the peer-to-peer program, which is the program we have running in Columbia County, we do have quite a bit of mentoring programs. So we usually have some in New York City. So we had some partnerships with companies such as Goldman Sachs. We had a mentoring program with one of the community centers in Brooklyn. We had another mentoring program with SCI, which is like a similar. It's not as, I would say, as known as a company as Goldman Sachs, but they do really good work in the community. I think they're more of a techie type of organization. And they were working with the School of Economics in Manhattan. And we also have a mentoring program with a law firm in D.C., Baker Hostler Law Firm, with Roosevelt High School in D.C. So we do a lot of group mentoring. So it's not the traditional one-on-one mentoring that people are used to, but it's very structured mentoring where we have topics such as financial literacy, proper decorum. Of course, we do college readiness, career readiness, but that is one of our core programs. And we also have parenting workshops where we educate parents about the signs of drug use with youth, how to communicate with your young people, et cetera. So we do peer-to-peer parent workshops and career mentoring.
How did you get involved in the program?
So I am originally from Jersey, and I moved to the D.C. area for grad school. And a lot of my background is usually in, like, social justice work with youth. So before, I was mainly teaching youth about, like, racial issues, gender issues. And substance abuse just sort of fit in that realm because usually a lot of the students who are exposed to it are, they have the same backgrounds, and a lot of the communities we work with are suffering from those sort of issues. So it just sort of works out. And how we address prevention is a bit unique because we look at the risk factor. So we look at, you know, why are students picking up drugs to begin with? And it's usually because, you know, there's no mentor figure in the home, or there's no support. There's bullying, there's, you know, all these other outside factors that, you know, on a community level we can address, but it also helps with prevention.
If you don't mind, will you talk about growing up in Jersey and talk about your lifestyle and the way you came up, which probably helped you want to be involved in social justice and things like that?
Yeah, so I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. I don't know if
who's
really
nature,
familiar with Trenton. But I grew up in Trenton. And a lot of it, the reason why I got into the social justice field is because there is a lack of things to do. And unlike, there is drug use in Trenton, but unlike in this area, what happens with boredom in Trenton becomes gangs, you know, drug dealing, et cetera. So I always seen that there was a lack of opportunities for young people. And if we can provide opportunities and provide some sort of hope, then we can sort of switch or at least motivate them to want to do other things in their community and beyond. So when I decided to leave Trenton, I decided, you know, wherever I go, I'm going to continue this work and work with young people and sort of empower them to be more than, you know, more than their community, whether they stay there or they decide to leave. So that's sort of where I'm going and where I'll continue.
All right. And for the doctor, how did you first start working with Mentor and the partnership that they have where you're able to speak to a lot of youth?
Well, it really started with these activities having to do with Shatter the Myth that we do in partnership with Mentor and many other organizations throughout the country. And with Mentor, they have this event every year at the Embassy of Sweden. And we provide some kind of the scientific expertise and try to disseminate information about the brain and give the kids some kind of insight as to what the brain does, what where it comes from, where are some of the vulnerabilities of their brain, and why are their drives that they feel, where they come from. So it's basically also prevention. It's a very central to our mission, a universal prevention, as we call it, but it's based on neuroscience. So try to give the kids some insight, some awareness about the things that drive them from a neurobiological point of view.
I hear an accent, sir. Will you tell the people that's listening where you're from?
And I'm from Alabama.
Roll Tide. That's right up my alley, man. Thank you. Good answer.
I'm from Argentina. I left very young, though. I was 18 when I left. I've been in the country for 32 years.
Oh, okay. Always wanted to be a doctor?
Always wanted to be in biology. I first did a lot of research on chronobiology, which is the molecular biology of jet lag. To define it in some way, melatonin and the internal clocks in the brain. So that was my research base, where I started doing basic research with animals. I killed a lot of animals around the clock. And eventually, about 12 years ago, I became associated with NIDA, which is the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and started to do a lot of learning and writing and giving lectures about the neuroscience of drug abuse and addiction.
Say, that's deep, man.
Yeah, you gotta give him a clap.
Yeah, I am. I'm just trying to really take in everything he just said. That was deep. I'm here.
Now, one of the things, like, you know, the doctor is really important. We had to get clearance, actually, to have him on. So our people had to talk to his people just to get him even cleared. What's your favorite part about working with youth in this field? Because this is a very complicated subject.
Well, I've done a lot of things in the realm of science. I've killed animals. I work with humans. I work with other scientists. I give lectures to all kinds of audiences. Mm-hmm. But really talking with young people and being able to, quote unquote, touch their brains and try to nudge their trajectories with good information, with evidence based, with facts, it's really particularly fulfilling, and it's very stimulating, and it's what really gives me the biggest kick in the morning to get up and affect some change in the community. I get a sense, when everything else is said and done, that I've made a difference. If I were able to today, for example, touch one brain, one kid, and nudge in the slightest their trajectory of life, then that was a good day. So really, it's very stimulating.
What would you say, like, there's a big debate that often happens where people say that addiction is a disease or it's not a disease. What's your take on that conversation?
It's a complex question. Obviously, the first initial decision to use a drug is a voluntary decision in most cases. But what people don't know is that in about 60 to 70% of the cases, there is an underlying mental condition that drives people to use that first time, either an undiagnosed mental illness, anxiety, or a problem with sleeping. And part of the problem is that we don't have a comprehensive healthcare system that catches all those people. Those people are at risk. And if they don't find solace or a solution to their problem in the traditional healthcare system, they will resort to drugs to try to self-medicate. So a big part of the problem is the self-medication problem. So that takes care of that initial voluntary need to use a drug. But once an addiction becomes established, it's definitely a condition of the brain. It's a disorder of the brain. You can measure, you can see how these different parts of the brain stop working in concert. They stop talking to each other, these different parts of the brain. And you can actually measure deficits in the way the brain uses energy, in the brain gets activated by a task, in a very significant way, very similar to the way you can measure disorder in a heart that is a disease. Similar things you can measure in a brain that is undergoing addiction.
Yeah, I was thinking, because I always battle with that whole discussion about whether it's a disease or an addiction. But if you take a mother who is pregnant and she's a drug addict and the baby is already addicted right from birth, I mean, what voluntary choice did the baby have?
Yeah, you know, he didn't have any choice. The real debate is whether or not the mother was responsible, whether she has a moral failure, she has to account, and to what extent she's responsible for this despicable behavior of getting her kid addicted while in the womb. So what is very hard to understand is that behavior of that mother. That is what people have trouble wrapping their heads around. How can a mother get her kid in the womb addicted? And it's difficult to understand because people don't quite understand that the brain is just another organ. It's like the liver or the kidney. And when that particular brain is not operational, has a disorder or a dysfunction, what gets hurt is the ability of that person to make decisions, to ponder the consequences of your actions. That's what's so special about the brain. And this is something that people have trouble understanding.
With a young infant, how much damage is done to the brain if a baby is born addicted? Because at that time, you know, they say like that's when the brain is like a sponge, so it's taking in everything.
It's true, and we had the epidemic of the crack babies in the 80s, mm-hmm. and now we have this epidemic, this surge in kids that are born with neonatal abstinence syndrome because of the opiate epidemic. But fortunately enough, research shows that the impact on the long-term cognitive abilities of these kids is not that great. There are subtle deficits in cognition, in head circumference and weight of these kids eventually, but all in all, the impact is much less than what we would have predicted. So these kids can recover. They can be rescued and if treated promptly once they are born. Their trajectories of life are not all that different from normal kids that were not exposed to drugs in the womb.
I wish I could take his voice when yeah. I'm debating and going back and forth. I could say, like, it is subtle, and I could go back and forth. So what's your day like? What's a typical day like for you being a scientist? Are you constantly traveling or constantly doing research?
I travel quite a lot. Nationally and internationally, I go to conferences. I spend a lot of time doing research on papers, articles, talking to other scientists, and trying to find the best ways to distill the best science to provide policymakers, teachers, parents, kids with the best available evidence so they are better informed to make decisions.
And for Kaya as well, what's some of your goals that you would like to see Mentor provide in the future?
Some of my goals may be different from Mentor's because my interest is not necessarily just prevention, and Mentor is, you know, primarily a drug prevention organization where my interest is more community level, especially at-risk communities, especially communities of color and working with at-risk youth, which Mentor does touch on just based on the history usually mm-hmm. of the communities that are suffering within the you know, the drug epidemic. But I would like to see Mentor eventually, like, you know, you and I talked about, start addressing more of the risk factors associated with it so we can sort of get at the core of, you know, why some of these young people are using. And I think that would satisfy a lot of our community partners as well.
How was Mentor founded?
Mentor was actually founded by Her Majesty Queen Sylvia of Sweden. So we are actually a Swedish-based organization. That's what a lot of people don't know about Mentor. Mm-hmm. And we are the USA branch of the organization. So we have 8 other affiliates. So there's a Mentor Germany, wow. there's a Mentor Sweden, a Mentor Latvia, a Mentor Lithuania,
yeah. Arabia
that serves a few different federations in Lebanon. I think I covered them all.
And doctor, what would you like to see more in youth programs when it comes to prevention, being your background and the things that you know?
Well, I think that knowing about the brain really makes a difference for kids. And mm-hmm. They really absorb this information whenever I have a chance to encounter them and to talk to them, either on one-on-one basis or in bigger lectures like we've been doing these days. They're really hungry for this information. And I think that schools would do well incorporating some of these very basic brain sciences in their curriculum, which is a cross-disciplinary kind of a domain that would benefit many of their core curriculum.
And what is it in the brain that causes addiction, that craves that drug that they take?
Well, we have a unit, a module in the brain that we share with the reptiles and with lower animals. And it's a module that is designed to reward behaviors that increase survival, like having sex, like eating, like nurturing the young. So that's a very primitive part of the brain. And Dopamine is a chemical in the brain that has a, plays a major role in reward, in reinforcing behaviors. The problem is that the dopamine, the way the brain is designed to respond to dopamine, the scale in which dopamine is released is, let's say, from 1 to 10. Sex would spike dopamine to a level of 10. Mm-hmm. Things like methamphetamine or cocaine or heroin would spike dopamine in those centers to a level of 100 or 1,000.
Wow.
So once the brain sees that kind of reward or reinforcing stimulus, nothing else compares to that. And it's just not designed to handle that level of massive reinforcement. So everything else for most people just becomes background noise. And the only thing that that brain now needs to get some kind of a reward or that is measurable is just the drug. And that becomes the major driver of behavior.
Wow. I got to give him a clap, man. 100? I got a question, Slay.
Mm-hmm.
Do either one of you like sports?
Yeah, for sure.
Because, I mean, you guys seem so busy with your work. I mean, do you have any time to do anything other than what you guys do?
I watch my team every Sunday play soccer.
Soccer?
In Argentina, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I do, unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a life outside of work, unfortunately.
So, what's like your worst thing that you have to do when you're going through your day as far as like your work as a scientist? What's something you hate?
Well, most of what I do is really very enjoyable. I don't consider what I do a job. And mm-hmm. I have several different things that I do and I enjoy them most. I'm old enough, so I have the luxury of ruling out of not doing things that I don't like. So I pretty much selected my life and mm-hmm. designed my life around things that I really enjoy doing. But there is bureaucracy, particularly working for the government. The mm-hmm. NIDA is an institute within the NIH, and that's part of the big bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So I find myself usually pushing the envelope and fighting this huge bureaucracy that is Washington, D.C. So that part of the job I don't like. I don't particularly hate it either, but it's a hindrance. Mm-hmm. It really precludes me from doing all the things that I would like on a regular basis.
Yeah, because it just seems like being a doctor, let alone a scientist, it'd be hard work. I'm actually a doctor of radio, so yeah. I doctor a lot of different things when people call in and ask questions.
Professor Slay.
Yes, I'm a professor and a doctor.
Yeah.
Not world renowned, but
no.
Kaya, what's like something that you would want to change or you dislike about your work?
I guess I would say more. It would be partly politics as well within and that whole idea that it's sort of what we were discussing, people not really understanding what addiction is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, honestly, is from my own community. Like when I think about when I talk to people in the Black community now that there's a, you know, quote unquote opioid epidemic, there's a lot of people who feel like, oh, well, you know, this isn't affecting Black people. And I'm like, I see just as many because, you know, I work in recovery as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I see just as many mm-hmm. Black faces as well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them think like, you know, our time was, you know, the crack epidemic, and now this is a different community's issue.
Yeah.
So I struggle with my community understanding that, no, you know, it's a lot of us who are still impacted by this quote-unquote opioid epidemic as well, and we should be having these conversations with our youth. But a lot of it, I think, has to do with them, you know, everything that's happened in the past, et cetera, and how people were treated during that particular time as far as it being more punitive, and now people are talking about recovery, et cetera, mm-hmm. that it's hard to get people in the Black and Latino community to listen and actually talk to their kids because they're so focused on, you know, well, this is what happened with us back then, and, you know, it's mm-hmm. different now, and this is this community, these particular communities' issues. So it's hard to get them to understand that, mm-hmm. no, this is
talk
affecting
that
us
talk.
Too. So
yeah, I got to give her a clap. I got to give her a
yeah,
clap.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to...
You hit on a key point.
Because I wanted to ask you, because we all know that heroin really tore apart the Black and Hispanic community. I mean, way back to the 70s, mm-hmm. there was songs like White Lines. They were talking about heroin. And I think a lot of people feel like, okay, no one did anything then. But now it's such a great problem because now it's
in the white community.
It's in a different community. Mm-hmm. As a mentor, how do you break that line to keep them focused on help is help? And whether it didn't happen then, we can't go back there and change it. But, you know, the help is still here now. Let's take advantage of it.
Well, first, I address two things. One, I think the misconception is that it wasn't an issue in the white community. I just think that they hid it. I think, okay. Mm-hmm. And even now, okay. It's still, for most people, if you see people dying or et cetera, people in some communities don't want to admit that their family members died to an opioid overdose. I think it was always an issue in other communities, too. It's just they weren't as vocal about it. And because our community was already vulnerable, it was, you know, it was, oh, this is a black issue. I don't think it just hit the white community. That's okay. One thing. Another thing I feel like is people don't understand that research evolves. I think, you know, people are finding out more research about what, you know, about like how it affects the brain, et cetera. And as research comes, more money comes. So there's more money to support certain things. But as far as addressing it with the youth, I don't even really have this sort of conversation with them per se when it comes to, you know, prevention or recovery. But I talk more about just opportunities and more about them being able to expand their network, them being able to create opportunities for themselves and their community. So I don't really focus on, you know, you need to look at, and that, honestly, it's mostly a conversation I have to have with adults. It's not even something I usually have to have with the youth. Mm-hmm. And also that's because the youth are not as familiar with, you know, what was going on back then. So it's not really a conversation I have to have with them, but it's a hard conversation I have to have with when I'm working with local partners and adults who were, you know, alive during that time and who may have had family members who are still in prison and who are suffering, et cetera. And now, you know, now they're doing recovery. These are the people I have to be able to talk to be able to support whatever we're doing, to have that conversation with them and say, you know, I understand your frustrations. I get it. You know, we all were affected. We all have family members who may be incarcerated because of, you know, the war on drugs, et cetera. But if we're going to progress and if we're really focusing on the progress of the youth, then that's what we should be doing. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's nothing we can do about what happened then, but we can definitely make a change about, you know, what's going on now.
All right. I got to give her a clap, man.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a caller.
Yes. And it was a lot.
It was a lot.
So I'm going to try my best and to summarize. But how do you feel, doctor, about the legalization of certain drugs like marijuana and what that kind of says to adolescents?
Well, this is a very complex issue, obviously, because mm-hmm. legalization has both advantages and disadvantages. The advantages would be that right now we are putting kids in jail for possessing marijuana, for example,
mm-hmm.
and we are destroying lives. We are changing trajectories by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We may be saving them from the intoxicating effects, from driving while intoxicated and things like that, but it's not free. There is a cost to putting young people in jail and through the criminal justice system. So it's a very complex phenomenon. It's a very complex decision.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, if you look at the entire picture, what we are worried about when we look at the epidemiology, about the statistics of legalizing versus not legalizing, what we look at primarily is the history and the lessons from tobacco and alcohol. Tobacco is a legal drug now, kills about 500,000 people a year.
Mm-hmm.
And alcohol is about between 38, 50, 60,000 people a year die from legal drugs, tobacco and alcohol. So our concern is that by legalizing a third drug, we learn too late that we have yet increased once again the death toll from having a legal drug. So you see there are many facets to these decisions. This is why I think that the key, the magic bullet really is on prevention. Let's forget about this debate that will lead nowhere, but let's institute a really powerful universal prevention program, extracurricular activities, after-school programs. Let's make our kids resilient. So the thinking behind using a drug will just not be there. It just becomes a non-issue. The kids won't have a need. There won't be poverty. So we need to solve all these problems that are around the issue of drug abuse, that it becomes a non-issue. So this is the solution in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
In the short term, this is indeed a real problem, what to do with legalization of drugs. And I don't have the solution. I'm a neuroscientist. I'm not a politician. But I recognize the complexity of the issue. We do a lot of damage by having these criminalized activities, particularly for young people who don't make the best decisions. So they find themselves in these situations that can damage their trajectory of life forever.
Is drug addiction hereditary?
Well, The studies show that there is about roughly, if you, the rule of thumb is about 50% of the risk comes from your family, from your genes, biological factors, and the rest is environmental. So that's the rule of thumb. It's about 50-50 between genes and environment.
Wow. Okay.
But having said that, if you live in a place where there is no drugs, it's 100% preventable, regardless of what genes you bring to the equation. If you are in a strong house, in a strong environment, with lots of things to do, your genes really play absolutely no role. If everything else in your life is hunky-dory and is pretty pink and you are happy in a robust environment, then it really doesn't matter what genes you have.
What makes the adolescent brain so important that it's a crucial point for youth to not be experimenting with drugs?
Yeah, the initial point or the research point that the evidence shows that if you start using a drug, if onset is early, let's say between 12 and 18 years of age, your risk of becoming addicted at some point in life are exponentially higher, regardless of the drug that you're talking about. So epidemiological evidence clearly shows early use equals much higher risk of addiction. The reason for that, I can use an analogy, try to nudge off trajectory a person who's walking or a person who's running. It's so much easier to just throw off somebody who's running next to you rather than somebody who's walking solidly past you. So the brain of an adolescent is like a brain that is running. Mm-hmm. It's developing at a very fast rate. So it's very easy for a toxic influence like a drug or bullying or lack of sleep to nudge that trajectory of that brain off course.
Of course, with this, I know you probably get a ton of questions about marijuana and the effect on the adolescent brain. What type of effect does that have? Because people often say, like, oh, it's just marijuana. It's a plant. It's an herb. Or,
well, the fact is that the endocannabinoid system, which is the system in the brain that is affected by marijuana, by the THC, you probably heard about THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana. It doesn't fall in a vacuum. It falls in a brain that uses a very specific system to develop, to learn, to establish new memories, and to grow and develop. The endocannabinoid system plays a very important role in all those functions. So when you perturb that system by putting artificial THC in that brain, then you are impairing all those functions, cognition, memory, coordination, motor coordination, which can have from mild to devastating consequences. For example, the mild consequences will be just to lower your SAT score from 100 to 80 or to 60, depending how much you use. The devastating consequences are if you're driving under the influence of marijuana, you could die of an accident. So it really depends how much you use, with which frequency, and what is the outcome that you're measuring. But no matter the frequency or the use, you are impairing your cognition to some extent.
Being that you research the brain so much, talk about the brain so much, what do you do to keep your brain healthy?
There are many things that you can do. One of the key things that I keep harping on is the fact that you need to sleep 8 to 9 hours a day. Whoa. Sleeping is really the unsung hero of brain performance. You need to sleep, then you need to eat properly, all your food groups, you need to exercise. And beyond those three things, you can do all sorts of things that are extra for brain performance, which is learning a new language or practice one if you have it and you don't practice it, learning an instrument. Social interaction, social intercourse is extremely important for brain performance. This is why social networks are so worrying to us brain scientists, because people become isolated in their own cocoons and bubbles, and they are lacking increasingly this function of social interaction with others, which is so important. Evolutionarily speaking, we have evolved to interact with others and not with screens. So this is something that we are worried, looking forward into the future, that this constant interaction with the screen and not with the person may have a very strong negative impact for brain health in the future of our kids.
There was one thing that you want someone to remember from your lectures and your research. What would that be?
Well, when I look at society, I see, regardless of what age, I talk about young people, kids, adolescents, and adults of all ages. I see most people going through life like zombies, really unaware of what is good for them, what is bad for them, what they want. And they just automatons, like zombie, like robots going through life. moved around like a bacteria in a petri dish. I would like people to become more aware of what they need, what they are, what they do, how their behaviors impact others and themselves. And I think that this idea of mindfulness, of becoming aware who we are and what we want and not being so much like automatic robots through life, I think it's very important, could have a very positive impact on all our lives.
You got one?
Yeah, I got one for Kai. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you had, let's say you won the lotto and you hit for like $60 million.
$60 million.
$60 million. Yeah. What would you do with it? And if you could, you know, form your own, not saying that you're not happy where you are, but what would you do with that type of money? And
yeah, so honestly, what I've been thinking, regardless if I get that kind of money or not, is creating some kind of community center. And especially in certain areas, like I also used to live in New Haven, Connecticut for a while. So to create some kind of community center that address like different factors, like, you know, we can do financial literacy. Students can have activities like boxing or basketball, et cetera. You know, we can do, you know, work with the community as far as with the parents, and the parents can come in. So I would just want some sort of community outlet where everyone in the community felt comfortable coming to, where I can address issues from all levels, whether it's with the youth, whether it's with community leaders, whether it's with the parents, but just something that's centralized. And that's usually lacking in a lot of communities, where either the community center is just not functioning at all, there's no support for it, or it just doesn't exist. But I would love to have like functional community centers in communities that, you know, really need it.
That stay away from politics.
It's a good thing there's no politicians in here.
Yeah, right.